Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, we don't have any comments. I think that's a good thing because there's a lot we need to discuss. So we finished our last program discussing the difficulties that Lawrence had in his digging, or his archaeological digging. Now today, what we want to do is we want to continue our discussion of some of Lawrence's other non-archaeological adventures under the cloak of archaeology. And I think we could start out, his brother Will came to visit, and he talked about him as being handling things lordly, or I want to just call it, he was lord of the manor at Carchemish. So I know you have a quote that you're just dying to read there. So,
well, I was just going to quote what you just said, basically that...
Well, now you can read it, too.
So that his brother wrote back home and saying that he was amazed. He was describing his brother, looking at him, standing, left him in the station, wearing white flannels, socks, and red slippers with a white Magdalen blazer, and was talking to the governor of Berwick. I'm not trying to pronounce that, but in a lordly fashion. And a lordly fashion is an interesting choice of words, according to Korda, because it's exactly the kind of life that Lawrence reproached his father for having abandoned. And so he actually lived in Carchemish as he imagined his father must have lived in Ireland, as a kind of a grand squire, an important person in the county, a gentleman. So there's some descriptions in here of what they call the stone exhibition house that he built, and it's kind of very interesting.
Yeah, it actually turned out to be like a 22-room palace.
Yes. Yes.
So being on an archaeological dig, as we said last time, had its difficulties, but it sounds like to me that T.E. made sure it was pretty much in like a manor or a British estate in the desert. You know, so I'll let you go ahead and read a few things there.
Well, starting the way he talks about how he started out as he was building it, it said that, it says that despite the fact that no building permit had yet arrived from Constantinople, the stone exhibition house was almost completed. At this time, when it first started out, it consisted of 11 rooms, two of them very large, and this house was to occupy a good deal of Lawrence's time and attention over the next 2 years. It had an impressive courtyard with a graceful stone entrance, and although the house was built of rough-dressed stone rather than adobe, in photographs it very much resembles a largish and rather fashionable home in Santa Fe. This is particularly true of the interior, with its hanging wall rugs, white plaster walls with deep, graceful niches for books and antiquities, carved wooden doors and beamed ceilings, which look just like the rough-hewn vigas used in New Mexico. Yeah, so I thought that was kind of funny, seeing it described like that, because you think about the hardship he goes through, and yet he's building quite a nice place there.
Right. And then he expanded another 11 rooms.
Yes. Eventually it had 22 rooms, yes.
So it also had like Roman tile floors.
Yes, I was going to read
about that. I'm just getting ahead of you all the time. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Well, I am the host. I'm allowed to introduce
this.
Yes, right.
Well, it just said that he spent a lot of time removing a Roman mosaic floor from a plowed field and reconstructing it. And it consisted of 144,000 tesserae, which are small vitreous tiles weighing over a ton. So he did that painstakingly, little by little.
So you can see that he had to have something going on all the time. I mean, he just, if he didn't have work to do, I bet he went insane. And so here, you know, he takes this Roman Roman tile floor and moves it, you know, and then puts it on the floor of the supposed archaeological house. So I think it's also interesting in that chapter and that he developed a real penchant for Oriental rugs.
Yes. Yes.
And I guess the place was just loaded with Oriental rugs.
Yes.
So one thing I just want to mention for, unless maybe you didn't, people didn't catch it, he's talking about Santa Fe, New Mexico, which Deborah and I have visited many times. And so that's really kind of a high culture area of New Mexico. So when I hear Corda talk about this house looking like Santa Fe, to me it's high culture, you know, out there in the desert with the locusts and the sandflies and every other vermin you could probably find. So it seemed like he had a real sense of, like even his brother Will said, even though they did not necessarily grow up on a manor, it seemed like he had a real sense of what that should look like.
Yes, he had a sense of quality, he certainly had a lot of people that came to visit him, and that was what's interesting is the way he way it's described also is that people came to visit, and that's one of the reasons why he had to make it bigger and make it up to 22 rooms, but he did get some of those rugs from some of his friends. From Aleppo. I'm not sure how to pronounce. They're Altoonians or something, but they were
a wealthy
Armenian family.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so they were into rug.
Yes.
Yeah. I just don't want to say rug trafficking. They were into the rug business.
Right.
You talk about everybody visiting him. I wanted to read on page 227. It says that, in short, in the area around Jerablus, Lawrence had become famous and admired despite the fact that he was a foreigner and a Christian. He had all the attributes of a desert hero. He was immensely strong, despite his small size. He described himself as a pocket Hercules, an outstanding shot, physically tireless, generous, absolutely fearless, and yet gentle in manner. His self-imposed Spartan regimen gave him yet another bond with the Arabs, who made do with a little flour and a few dates out of necessity. Unlike most Englishmen, Lawrence could survive on their meager diet and walk barefoot where they did, and he could get back to work together without threats or use of force, in contrast to the German officials who, to Lawrence's rage, made full use of the whip, indeed considered it indispensable. So he really attracted the love and respect of the Arabic peoples.
Yes, at one point he said, I don't have it written down where, but he was running foot races with the workers.
Yeah.
and another time he devised like contests to help to get the different and divide them up in teams to see who could dig the fastest. So he did things like that to make it more fun.
And which teams could lift the big rocks and the big cement blocks off the poor Hittite city that had been crushed.
Yes. You know,
so in some ways, if you really look at that, I mean, a little bit deeper than just kind of like the fun part of it, is it seems like he had a knack for getting the Arabic peoples to unite together and to work together. And so I think Corda brings it out really clearly that he was actually being prepared to help fight the Arab revolt against the Turks. He was getting prepared to do that, even though he didn't know it. And that, you know, it's not like he had the plan to go in there and say, well, I'm going to prepare myself for the Arab revolt. He had no idea he was even going to do the Arab revolt. But it's almost like Winston Churchill, when he looked back on his life, and he felt he had been prepared for World War II. And it's almost the same thing, is that Lawrence was being prepared to make sure that Arab revolt, you know, happened and that they beat the Turks. And hopefully everyone out there in listening into these programs realize that the Middle East we see today has a lot to do with how T.E. Lawrence organized it. I mean, he really was a nation builder, and I mean, it definitely has its problems, but there are problems of character he could not solve. And we know that that man, all mankind, is we have such deep character flaws we cannot fix on our own. It's going to take, well, God and His Great Spirit to get those fixed. And so, but still, I mean, it's almost like, if I'm reading this correctly, and you can agree with me or disagree with me, but it's almost like he became like a wise man. It's like they came to court when they came to his house. You know, they got wisdom from him and advice from him. And do you read it the same way?
Yes, yes. Well, it says here that Lawrence's abode near the site of the ancient Hittite city was more like a court than a scholar's residence. People called on him constantly, and indeed it had become necessary to expand the house's 22 rooms. It also says that he continued his meager diet, but he served guests good food, I guess.
Yeah.
He served them many courses.
Yeah.
So he was a good host.
Oh, yeah.
But he did, it does seem like he helped with some of the problems that came up between the peoples. And so that's what you're saying,
right,
there.
Right.
Because there was one instance where he definitely did help solve a problem and became a lifelong friend of one of, I forget his name, the one of the leaders in that area.
One of the sheiks, yes.
Yes.
Yeah, he stopped a blood feud.
Right.
Yeah, he stopped a poor guy from getting executed, you know. So I just feel like this is a, you know, just a fascinating, fascinating section. And it's like he was lord of the manor, but he was like the village wise man. And, he did know how, you know, to help people. I think one of the other things is we just don't want to forget he also grew in popularity with the people he worked with. And I do want to come back and talk about the Arabic peoples that he did befriend, and they certainly loved him. And I did go through one list of, you know, British soldiers that and the military men and even people in government who really did learn to support him. But there's Carter comes up with a new list, and I don't want to get into the new list because I need to kind of get online and just figure out who they really were. But there was a lot more people, and of course, Woolley was another archaeologist that they really became close friends. And then I do think it's interesting, we're not going to spend a lot of time on this, but there is a poet at that time, James Elroy Flecker, that he got close to. And here he was in the British government. And I think I forget whether he went to Oxford or not, but they did have a friendship. I think it was based more on literature and based on he thought his poetry was really pretty good. And can you imagine these two kind of like scholars in the desert? I mean, that's essentially what they were, two scholars in the desert. And it does remind me a little bit of when I was in college. And, of course, my wife knows I had a very good friend who we were both in literature. We were both studying English literature, and we were both taking a concentration in poetry writing. And I remember one summer we went off onto this island off the coast of the east coast of the United States, and we were going to spend 2 weeks writing, 2 weeks writing on the beach. And I think we spent more like 2 weeks at the seashore, you know, and at the, you know, at the arcades and the boardwalks and eating pizza rather than writing. But anyway, it was a dream. You know, it was a dream of ours to write, and actually, none of us, neither one of us, have published, maybe as we could have. And I know I was told then that I was just lazy. I could have been published before I left school, but he did become a photographer, and of course, I do teach English literature, so we came around to it in some ways. So let's talk about now. For the rest of this program, let's talk about his, let's say, his other adventures under the cloak of archaeology. And I think it's interesting on page 221 that Korda brings out that for a short time he was a gun runner. And that's I'll just go there, page 221. This is in the very middle of the page, and this is where I think his adventurous spirit really comes out. I don't think he was necessarily bored with archaeology, but I just wondered if it could really captivate him as much as some of these other things did. But here he says in the middle of page 221, says, Lawrence had a way of getting involved in matters far beyond the ordinary demands of field archaeology, like smuggling rifles into the British consulate. That's pretty amazing. He said, echoes of Lawrence's adventures are strewn throughout his letters. It is possible, for example, that he and Dahum, now that was one of his Arab assistants, were thrown into a Turkish prison as deserters from the Turkish army. Lawrence must have been in Arab clothes at the time, and they were badly beaten there. Lawrence's contacts with the Kurdish revolutionaries, and to a lesser extent the Armenians, seem to have more in the nature of a high-spirited adventure than of serious intelligence work, but had the full approval of Woolley, who realized in the event of an uprising in the area around Carchemish, the two Englishmen would be at the mercy of the Kurds. Good relations with the Kurdish leaders were therefore a necessary precaution. Woolley even went so far as to arrange for the settlement of a three-generation blood feud between the two of the most important Kurdish sheikhs, Buswari and his great enemy Shalom Bey, in the expedition house, with himself as imperial referee, passing out chocolates to the party of nine great Kurds. So I think we were referring to that.
Right.
All right. Now, visitors to the excavation site were startled to see that the watchman was a villainous-looking, heavily armed Kurdish brigand whom Lawrence had chosen because his reputation alone could keep away other marauding Kurds in the event of an uprising. Any doubts about what such an uprising might entail had been erased when Lawrence visited nearby town of Mazib and Birchik in Arab clothing. He found the body of the Armenian Christian doctor still lying in the street in Mazib 2 days after the doctor had been shot by Kurdish militants, and he described the Kurdish hill villagers as running around with guns and looking for another Christian to kill. So it really is amazing, you know, what he got involved in. And people at the British consulate were absolutely terrified that there was going to be this uprising and they were going to be killed if they didn't have weapons. And so it was Lawrence and a few other soldiers that actually, you know, ran these guns from the coast into the consulate. And so what does that have to do with archaeology? Not very much.
Well, it does seem that he knew how he learned how to survive, because that was archaeology in kind of a volatile, dangerous environment.
That's right. That's right. Of course, he was a good shot, and I think the Arabs knew that too. So it's just amazing that he would get involved in gun running, and of course he even referred to it in his writing as his iniquity. You know, so I think he had a sense of law. Law there, and I don't think he really felt any guilt about it, but he knew he was breaking Turkish law. But it seems like he and Woolley didn't really care about Turkish law anyway, and they could really bully their way through about anything. So that's really brought out. All right, now let's talk about the next big thing here, this non-archaeological thing, and this was their map making to help protect the Suez Canal for British interests. So we can find that on page 232, and I think this is probably one of the most astounding things, you know, in this chapter. And I do think it's things were going well, you know, at the Carchemish site. They were finding more things. The British were happy. But listen to this. This is actually, we're going to go to page 232. they needed to do a map survey of the Sinai Peninsula. And this was from Beersheba to Aqaba. Now, if that sounds familiar, I mean, it should be, because, when we opened this book, we opened at Aqaba, and how he won, the port city of Aqaba. And here, about 3 years before that battle, he was already at Aqaba. I mean, he was making a map of that area. But here's how it's explained. It says, by mid-December, however, a new and more exciting job had turned up, one that Lawrence, with his thirst for adventure, could hardly resist. The project had powerful sponsors, including Field Marshal of the Earl of Kitchener himself, and was one for which Lawrence was unusually well-suited. Throughout the 1870s and early 1880s, the British Palestine Exploration Fund had carried out a meticulous 1-inch-to-the-mile map survey of Western Palestine, which ended on a line drawn from the west to east through Gaza and Beersheba to Masada on the western shore of the Dead Sea. Kitchener himself had at one point led the survey, drawing up the first modern map of the Holy Land, even establishing the borders of future states such as Lebanon and Syria. The work, which was ultimately published in 8 volumes, had intense military as well as biblical importance. In 1913, as the Germans intensified their diplomatic effort to bind Turkey to what would soon become known as the Central Powers, and that is Germany and Austria-Hungary, in the event of war, and as the Turkish leaders hemmed and hawed and upped their price, attempting to negotiate simultaneously with both sides, Kitchener, now the British agent and consul general, the equivalent of a viceroy in Egypt, felt it urgent to have the survey completed, especially the Sinai Peninsula from Beersheba to Aqaba, since in the event of war with the Ottoman Empire, the Turkish army would certainly attempt to cross this area and seize or block the Suez Canal. And so we know, even from Bible prophecy, that it said that Britain would possess the gates of its enemies. And here's an absolute situation where the British were trying to protect their interests in keeping the Suez Canal open, because it gave them access to India, gave them access to the biggest part of their empire. And so what they needed to do is they needed to map the Sinai Peninsula. That wasn't done yet. And who was the best guy for that job? T.E. Lawrence. And T.E. Lawrence had a photographic memory for geography. And so he had done some map making in his life, and now they needed to get him to do that. Now, it's interesting, they had to secure permission from the Turks, but it seems like they had no trouble doing that, because the Turks were playing both sides of the fence. They wanted to keep the British on their side, and they wanted to keep the Germans on their side. And in some ways, they really didn't want to side with the Germans. And so essentially what they decided to do is to hide the fact that they had a military interest in mapping the Sinai. They called upon Woolley, and they called upon Lawrence to map the Sinai Peninsula under the guise that they were looking for the route where Moses took the Israelites from Egypt to the Promised Land. And so they were calling it a biblical, this was a biblical effort. And, of course, if you read through these pages, all the way up through, page 235, I mean, Lawrence really did try to find these spots. He tried to find out, the cities where the Bible says where Moses stopped, but they found nothing.
Right.
They found nothing.
They found nothing, yes.
And the reason, the Korda gives, the reason why they found nothing is because they were wandering in the desert. They didn't build houses. The Israelites didn't build cities. They were wandering in the desert. They kept moving.
They're wandering like the Bedouins.
Yeah, they were wandering like the Bedouins. Right. So, but anyway, they still got their map, and so I do think it's kind of really interesting that this was all done to, you know, to you know, promote British interests. And you know, let me just read to you a little bit instead of me trying to just explain this to everybody. Let me just read, let's say, page 234. Maybe what I'll do is, I'll just start at page 230 at the very bottom. It says, it almost goes without saying that Hogarth was a member of the Palestine Exploration Fund Committee and recommended that one of them approach Kenyon, who was another famous archaeologist of the British Museum. Kenyon replied almost immediately, "Hogarth concurs in the idea of lending our men from Jarablus to the PEF, or the Palestine Exploration Fund Survey, and suggests at the time, both should go. The names are C.L. Woolley and T.E. Lawrence. The former is a senior man with rather wider experience. The latter is better at colloquial Arabic and gets on very well with the natives. He has, I think, more of the instincts of an explorer, but is very shy. Hogarth can tell you more about them if you wish." Once again, Hogarth, who seems always to have been in the right place at the right time, had pushed forward the name of his protege and moved Lawrence from the land of lotus eating into that exploration and high strategy. So I think that's absolutely amazing. Again, that here, as an archaeology student, as someone still young enough, you know, to be interested in things, he was actually being prepared for later. Now, also in that chapter, we're not going to have any more discussion, but they also not only went through the Sinai Peninsula, they also went through the Taurus Mountains, and there they learned so many more things. So we're out of time for today's program. Next time, we're going to start a new chapter. We're going to start on Cairo, so you might want to read ahead. Remember, for this current series of programs, we're using Michael Korda's book, Hero, The Life and Legend of Lawrence of Arabia. You can buy this book at Amazon.com. You can find a used copy of the book at abebooks.com. And, of course, you can also check your local library. Now, please write me any comments you may have about T.E. Lawrence as an adventurous archaeologist. I would love to hear what you have to say. So you can write me any comments at jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at jbliterature1. And you can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.